Public life of Mr. Tolrumble, once mayor of Mudfog. Mudfog is a pleasant town, a remarkably pleasant town, situated in a charming hollow by the side of a river, from which river, Mudfog derives an agreeable scent of pitch, tar, coals, and rope yarn, a roving population in oilskin hats, a pretty steady influx of drunken bargemen, and a great many other maritime advantages. There is a good deal of water about Mudfog, and yet it is not exactly the sort of town for a watering place, either. Water is a perverse sort of element at the best of times, and in Mudfog it is particularly so. In winter, it comes oozing down the streets and tumbling over the fields, nay, rushes into the very cellars and kitchens of the houses, with a lavish prodigality that might well be dispensed with, but in the hot summer weather it will dry up, and turn green, and, although green is a very good color in its way, especially in grass, still it certainly is not becoming to water, and it cannot be denied that the beauty of Mudfog is rather impaired, even by this trifling circumstance. Mudfog is a healthy place, very healthy, damp, perhaps, but none the worse for that. It's quite a mistake to suppose that damp is unwholesome. Plants thrive best in damp situations, and why shouldn't men? The inhabitants of Mudfog are unanimous in asserting that there exists not a finer race of people on the face of the earth. Here we have an indisputable and voracious contradiction of the vulgar error at once. So, admitting Mudfog to be damp, we distinctly state that it is salubrious. The town of Mudfog is extremely picturesque. Limehouse and Ratcliffe Highway are both something like it, but they give you a very faint idea of Mudfog. There are a great many more public houses in Mudfog, more than in Ratcliffe Highway and Limehouse put together. The public buildings, too, are very imposing. We consider the town hall one of the finest specimens of shed architecture, extant. It is a combination of the pigsty and tea garden box orders, and the simplicity of its design is of surpassing beauty. The idea of placing a large window on one side of the door, and a small one on the other, is particularly happy. There is a fine old Doric beauty, too, about the padlock and scraper, which is strictly in keeping with the general effect. In this room do the mayor and corporation of Mudfog assemble together in solemn council for the public weal. Seated on the massive wooden benches, which, with a table in the center, form the only furniture of the whitewashed apartment, the sage men of Mudfog spend hour after hour in grave deliberation. Here they settle at what hour of the night the public houses shall be closed, at what hour of the morning they shall be permitted to open, how soon it shall be lawful for people to eat their dinner on church days, and other great political questions, and sometimes, long after silence has fallen on the town, and the distant lights from the shops and houses have ceased to twinkle, like far-off stars, to the sight of the boatmen on the river, the illumination in the two unequal-sized windows of the town hall warns the inhabitants of Mudfog that its little body of legislators, like a larger and better-known body of the same genus, a great deal more noisy, and not a whit more profound, are patriotically dozing away in company, far into the night, for their country's good. Among this knot of sage and learned men, no one was so eminently distinguished, during many years, for the quiet modesty of his appearance and demeanor, as Nicholas Tolrumble, the well-known coal dealer. However exciting the subject of discussion, however animated the tone of the debate, or however warm the personalities exchanged, and even in Mudfog we get personal sometimes, Nicholas Tolrumble was always the same. To say truth, Nicholas, being an industrious man, and always up betimes, was apt to fall asleep when a debate began, and to remain asleep till it was over, when he would wake up very much refreshed, and give his vote with the greatest complacency. The fact was, that Nicholas Tolrumble, knowing that everybody there had made up his mind beforehand, considered the talking as just a long botheration about nothing at all, and to the present hour it remains a question, whether, on this point at all events, Nicholas Tolrumble was not pretty near right. Time, which strews a man's head with silver, sometimes fills his pockets with gold. As he gradually performed one good office for Nicholas Tolrumble, he was obliging enough, not to omit the other. Nicholas began life in a wooden tenement of 4 feet square, with a capital of 2 and 9 pence, and a stock in trade of 3 bushels and a half of coals, exclusive of the large lump which hung, by way of signboard, outside. Then he enlarged the shed, and kept a truck, then he left the shed, and the truck too, and started a donkey and a Mrs. Tolrumble, then he moved again and set up a cart. The cart was soon afterwards exchanged for a wagon, and so he went on like his great predecessor Whittington, only without a cat for a partner, increasing in wealth and fame, until at last he gave up business altogether, and retired with Mrs. Tolrumble and family to Mudfog Hall, which he had himself erected, on something which he attempted to delude himself into the belief was a hill, about a quarter of a mile distant from the town of Mudfog. About this time, it began to be murmured in Mudfog that Nicholas Tulrumble was growing vain and haughty, that prosperity and success had corrupted the simplicity of his manners, and tainted the natural goodness of his heart, in short, that he was setting up for a public character, and a great gentleman, and affected to look down upon his old companions with compassion and contempt. Whether these reports were at the time well-founded, or not, certain it is that Mrs. Tulrumble very shortly afterwards started a four-wheel chaise, driven by a tall postillion in a yellow cap, that Mr. Tulrumble Jr. took to smoking cigars, and calling the footman a feller, and that Mr. Tulrumble from that time forth, was no more seen in his old seat in the chimney corner of the Lighterman's Arms at night. This looked bad, but, more than this, it began to be observed that Mr. Nicholas Tulrumble attended the corporation meetings more frequently than heretofore, and he no longer went to sleep as he had done for so many years, but propped his eyelids open with his two forefingers, that he read the newspapers by himself at home, and that he was in the habit of indulging abroad in distant and mysterious allusions to masses of people, and the property of the country, and productive power, and the moneyed interest, all of which denoted and proved that Nicholas Tulrumble was either mad, or worse, and it puzzled the good people of Mudfog amazingly. At length, about the middle of the month of October, Mr. Tulrumble and family went up to London, the middle of October being, as Mrs. Tulrumble informed her acquaintance in Mudfog, the very height of the fashionable season. Somehow or other, just about this time, despite the health-preserving air of Mudfog, the mayor died. It was a most extraordinary circumstance. He had lived in Mudfog for 85 years. The corporation didn't understand it at all. Indeed, it was with great difficulty that one old gentleman, who was a great stickler for forms, was dissuaded from proposing a vote of censure on such unaccountable conduct. Strange as it was, however, die he did, without taking the slightest notice of the corporation, and the corporation were imperatively called upon to elect his successor. So, they met for the purpose, and being very full of Nicholas Tulrumble just then, and Nicholas Tulrumble being a very important man, they elected him, and rode off to London by the very next post to acquaint Nicholas Tulrumble with his new elevation. Now, it being November time, and Mr. Nicholas Tulrumble being in the capital, it fell out that he was present at the Lord Mayor's show and dinner, at sight of the glory and splendour whereof, he, Mr. Tulrumble, was greatly mortified, inasmuch as the reflection would force itself on his mind, that, had he been born in London instead of in Mudfog, he might have been a Lord Mayor too, and have patronized the judges, and been affable to the Lord Chancellor, and friendly with the Premier, and coldly condescending to the Secretary to the Treasury, and have dined with a flag behind his back, and done a great many other acts and deeds which unto Lord Mayors of London peculiarly appertain. The more he thought of the Lord Mayor, the more enviable a personage he seemed. To be a king was all very well, but what was the king to the Lord Mayor? When the king made a speech, everybody knew it was somebody else's writing, whereas here was the Lord Mayor, talking away for half an hour all out of his own head, amidst the enthusiastic applause of the whole company, while it was notorious that the king might talk to his parliament till he was black in the face without getting so much as a single cheer. As all these reflections passed through the mind of Mr. Nicholas Tulrumble, the Lord Mayor of London appeared to him the greatest sovereign on the face of the earth, beating the Emperor of Russia all to nothing, and leaving the Great Mogul immeasurably behind. Mr. Nicholas Tulrumble was pondering over these things, and inwardly cursing the fate which had pitched his coal shed in Mudfog, when the letter of the corporation was put into his hand. A crimson flush mantled over his face as he read it, for visions of brightness were already dancing before his imagination. "My dear," said Mr. Tulrumble to his wife, "they have elected me mayor of Mudfog." "Lor' a mussy," said Mrs. Tulrumble, "why, what's become of old Sniggs?" "The late Mr. Sniggs, Mrs. Tulrumble," said Mr. Tulrumble sharply, for he by no means approved of the notion of unceremoniously designating a gentleman who filled the high office of mayor, as old Sniggs, the late Mr. Sniggs, Mrs. Tulrumble, is dead. The communication was very unexpected, but Mrs. Tulrumble only ejaculated "Lor' a mussy," once again, as if a mayor were a mere ordinary Christian, at which Mr. Tulrumble frowned gloomily. "What a pity 'tant in London, ain't it?" said Mrs. Tulrumble, after a short pause. "What a pity 'tant in London, where you might have had a show." "I might have a show in Mudfog, if I thought proper, I apprehend," said Mr. Tulrumble mysteriously. "Lor, so you might, I declare," replied Mrs. Tulrumble. "And a good one too," said Mr. Tulrumble. "Delightful!" exclaimed Mrs. Tulrumble. One which would rather astonish the ignorant people down there, said Mr. Tulrumble. It would kill them with envy, said Mrs. Tulrumble. So it was agreed that His Majesty's lieges in Mudfog should be astonished with splendor, and slaughtered with envy, and that such a show should take place as had never been seen in that town, or in any other town before, no, not even in London itself. On the very next day after the receipt of the letter, down came the tall postillion in a postchaise, not upon one of the horses, but inside, actually inside the chaise, and, driving up to the very door of the town hall, where the corporation were assembled, delivered a letter, written by the Lord knows who, and signed by Nicholas Tulrumble, in which Nicholas said, all through four sides of closely written, gilt-edged, hot-pressed, Bath Post letter paper, that he responded to the call of his fellow townsmen with feelings of heartfelt delight, that he accepted the arduous office which their confidence had imposed upon him, that they would never find him shrinking from the discharge of his duty, that he would endeavor to execute his functions with all the dignity which their magnitude and importance demanded, and a great deal more to the same effect. But even this was not all. The tall postillion produced from his right-hand top boot a damp copy of that afternoon's number of the county paper, and there, in large type, running the whole length of the very first column, was a long address from Nicholas Tulrumble to the inhabitants of Mudfog, in which he said that he cheerfully complied with their requisition, and, in short, as if to prevent any mistake about the matter, told them over again what a grand fellow he meant to be, in very much the same terms as those in which he had already told them all about the matter in his letter. The corporation stared at one another very hard at all this, and then looked as if for explanation to the tall postillion, but as the tall postillion was intently contemplating the gold tassel on the top of his yellow cap, and could have afforded no explanation whatever, even if his thoughts had been entirely disengaged, they contented themselves with coughing very dubiously, and looking very grave. The tall postillion then delivered another letter, in which Nicholas Tulrumble informed the corporation, that he intended repairing to the town hall, in grand state and gorgeous procession, on the Monday afternoon next ensuing. At this the corporation looked still more solemn, but, as the epistle wound up with a formal invitation to the whole body to dine with the mayor on that day, at Mudfog Hall, Mudfog Hill, Mudfog, they began to see the fun of the thing directly, and sent back their compliments, and they'd be sure to come. Now there happened to be in Mudfog, as somehow or other there does happen to be, in almost every town in the British dominions, and perhaps in foreign dominions too, we think it very likely, but, being no great traveller, cannot distinctly say, there happened to be, in Mudfog, a merry-tempered, pleasant-faced, good-for-nothing sort of vagabond, with an invincible dislike to manual labour, and an unconquerable attachment to strong beer and spirits, whom everybody knew, and nobody, except his wife, took the trouble to quarrel with, who inherited from his ancestors the appellation of Edward Twigger, and rejoiced in the _sobriquet_ of Bottlenose Ned. He was drunk upon the average once a day, and penitent upon an equally fair calculation once a month, and when he was penitent, he was invariably in the very last stage of maudlin intoxication. He was a ragged, roving, roaring kind of fellow, with a burly form, a sharp wit, and a ready head, and could turn his hand to anything when he chose to do it. He was by no means opposed to hard labor on principle, for he would work away at a cricket match by the day together, running, and catching, and batting, and bowling, and reveling in toil which would exhaust a galley slave. He would have been invaluable to a fire office, never was a man with such a natural taste for pumping engines, running up ladders, and throwing furniture out of two pair of stairs windows, nor was this the only element in which he was at home. He was a humane society in himself, a portable drag, an animated life preserver, and had saved more people, in his time, from drowning, than the Plymouth lifeboat, or Captain Manby's apparatus. With all these qualifications, notwithstanding his dissipation, Bottlenose Ned was a general favorite, and the authorities of Mudfog, remembering his numerous services to the population, allowed him in return to get drunk in his own way, without the fear of stocks, fine, or imprisonment. He had a general license, and he showed his sense of the compliment by making the most of it. We have been thus particular in describing the character and avocations of Bottlenose Ned, because it enables us to introduce a fact politely, without hauling it into the reader's presence with indecent haste by the head and shoulders, and brings us very naturally to relate, that on the very same evening on which Mr. Nicholas Tulrumble and family returned to Mudfog, Mr. Tulrumble's new secretary, just imported from London, with a pale face and light whiskers, thrust his head down to the very bottom of his neckcloth tie, in at the taproom door of the Lighterman's Arms, and inquiring whether one Ned Twigger was luxuriating within, announced himself as the bearer of a message from Nicholas Tulrumble, Esquire, requiring Mr. Twigger's immediate attendance at the hall, on private and particular business. It being by no means Mr. Twigger's interest to affront the mayor, he rose from the fireplace with a slight sigh, and followed the light-whiskered secretary through the dirt and wet of Mudfog streets, up to Mudfog Hall, without further ado. Mr. Nicholas Tulrumble was seated in a small cavern with a skylight, which he called his library, sketching out a plan of the procession on a large sheet of paper, and into the cavern the secretary ushered Ned Twigger. "Well, Twigger," said Nicholas Tulrumble, condescendingly. There was a time when Twigger would have replied, "Well, Nick." But that was in the days of the truck, and a couple of years before the donkey, so, he only bowed. "I want you to go into training, Twigger," said Mr. Tulrumble. "What for, sir?" inquired Ned, with a stare. "Hush, hush, Twigger," said the mayor. "Shut the door, Mr. Jennings. Look here, Twigger." As the mayor said this, he unlocked a high closet, and disclosed a complete suit of brass armor, of gigantic dimensions. "I want you to wear this next Monday, Twigger," said the mayor. "Bless your heart and soul, sir," replied Ned, "you might as well ask me to wear a 74-pounder, or a cast-iron boiler." "Nonsense, Twigger, nonsense," said the mayor. "I couldn't stand under it, sir," said Twigger, "it would make mashed potatoes of me, if I attempted it." "Pooh, pooh, Twigger," returned the mayor. "I tell you I have seen it done with my own eyes, in London, and the man wasn't half such a man as you are, either." "I should as soon have thought of a man's wearing the case of an 8-day clock to save his linen," said Twigger, casting a look of apprehension at the brass suit. "It's the easiest thing in the world," rejoined the mayor. "It's nothing," said Mr. Jennings. "When you're used to it," added Ned. "You do it by degrees," said the mayor. "You would begin with one piece tomorrow, and two the next day, and so on, till you had got it all on. Mr. Jennings, give Twigger a glass of rum. Just try the breastplate, Twigger. Stay, take another glass of rum first. Help me to lift it, Mr. Jennings. Stand firm, Twigger. There. It isn't half as heavy as it looks, is it?" Twigger was a good strong, stout fellow, so, after a great deal of staggering, he managed to keep himself up, under the breastplate, and even contrived, with the aid of another glass of rum, to walk about in it, and the gauntlets into the bargain. He made a trial of the helmet, but was not equally successful, inasmuch as he tipped over instantly, an accident which Mr. Tulrumble clearly demonstrated to be occasioned by his not having a counteracting weight of brass on his legs. "Now, wear that with grace and propriety on Monday next," said Tulrumble, "and I'll make your fortune." "I'll try what I can do, sir," said Twigger. "It must be kept a profound secret," said Tulrumble. "Of course, sir," replied Twigger. "And you must be sober," said Tulrumble, "perfectly sober." Mr. Twigger at once solemnly pledged himself to be as sober as a judge, and Nicholas Tulrumble was satisfied, although, had we been Nicholas, we should certainly have exacted some promise of a more specific nature, inasmuch as, having attended the Mudfog Assizes in the evening more than once, we can solemnly testify to having seen judges with very strong symptoms of dinner under their wigs. However, that's neither here nor there. The next day, and the day following, and the day after that, Ned Twigger was securely locked up in the small cavern with the skylight, hard at work at the armor. With every additional piece he could manage to stand upright in, he had an additional glass of rum, and at last, after many partial suffocations, he contrived to get on the whole suit, and to stagger up and down the room in it, like an intoxicated effigy from Westminster Abbey. Never was man so delighted as Nicholas Tulrumble, never was woman so charmed as Nicholas Tulrumble's wife. Here was a sight for the common people of Mudfog. A live man in brass armor. Why, they would go wild with wonder. The day, Monday, arrived. If the morning had been made to order, it couldn't have been better adapted to the purpose. They never showed a better fog in London on Lord Mayor's Day, than enwrapped the town of Mudfog on that eventful occasion. It had risen slowly and surely from the green and stagnant water with the first light of morning, until it reached a little above the lamppost tops, and there it had stopped, with a sleepy, sluggish obstinacy, which bade defiance to the sun, who had got up very bloodshot about the eyes, as if he had been at a drinking party overnight, and was doing his day's work with the worst possible grace. The thick damp mist hung over the town like a huge gauze curtain. All was dim and dismal. The church steeples had bidden a temporary adieu to the world below, and every object of lesser importance, houses, barns, hedges, trees, and barges, had all taken the veil. The church clock struck one. A cracked trumpet from the front garden of Mudfog Hall produced a feeble flourish, as if some asthmatic person had coughed into it accidentally. The gate flew open, and out came a gentleman, on a moist sugar-colored charger, intended to represent a herald, but bearing a much stronger resemblance to a court card on horseback. This was one of the circus people, who always came down to Mudfog at that time of the year, and who had been engaged by Nicholas Tulrumble expressly for the occasion. There was the horse, whisking his tail about, balancing himself on his hind legs, and flourishing away with his forefeet, in a manner which would have gone to the hearts and souls of any reasonable crowd. But a Mudfog crowd never was a reasonable one, and in all probability never will be. Instead of scattering the very fog with their shouts, as they ought most indubitably to have done, and were fully intended to do, by Nicholas Tulrumble, they no sooner recognized the herald, than they began to growl forth the most unqualified disapprobation at the bare notion of his riding like any other man. If he had come out on his head indeed, or jumping through a hoop, or flying through a red-hot drum, or even standing on one leg with his other foot in his mouth, they might have had something to say to him. But for a professional gentleman to sit astride in the saddle, with his feet in the stirrups, was rather too good a joke. So, the herald was a decided failure, and the crowd hooted with great energy, as he pranced ingloriously away. On the procession came. We are afraid to say how many supernumeraries there were, in striped shirts and black velvet caps, to imitate the London watermen, or how many base imitations of running footmen, or how many banners, which, owing to the heaviness of the atmosphere, could by no means be prevailed on to display their inscriptions. Still less do we feel disposed to relate how the men who played the wind instruments, looking up into the sky, we mean the fog, with musical fervor, walked through pools of water and hillocks of mud, till they covered the powdered heads of the running footmen aforesaid with splashes, that looked curious, but not ornamental, or how the barrel organ performer put on the wrong stop, and played one tune while the band played another, or how the horses, being used to the arena, and not to the streets, would stand still and dance, instead of going on and prancing, all of which are matters which might be dilated upon to great advantage, but which we have not the least intention of dilating upon. Notwithstanding. Oh! It was a grand and beautiful sight to behold a corporation in glass coaches, provided at the sole cost and charge of Nicholas Tulrumble, coming rolling along, like a funeral out of mourning, and to watch the attempts the corporation made to look great and solemn, when Nicholas Tulrumble himself, in the four-wheel chaise, with the tall postillion, rolled out after them, with Mr. Jennings on one side to look like a chaplain, and a supernumerary on the other, with an old life guardsman's saber, to imitate the sword-bearer, and to see the tears rolling down the faces of the mob as they screamed with merriment. This was beautiful. And so was the appearance of Mrs. Tulrumble and son, as they bowed with grave dignity out of their coach window to all the dirty faces that were laughing around them. But it is not even with this that we have to do, but with the sudden stopping of the procession at another blast of the trumpet, whereat, and whereupon, a profound silence ensued, and all eyes were turned towards Mudfog Hall, in the confident anticipation of some new wonder. They won't laugh now, Mr. Jennings, said Nicholas Tulrumble. I think not, sir, said Mr. Jennings. See how eager they look, said Nicholas Tulrumble. Aha! The laugh will be on our side now, eh, Mr. Jennings? No doubt of that, sir, replied Mr. Jennings, and Nicholas Tulrumble, in a state of pleasurable excitement, stood up in the four-wheel chaise, and telegraphed gratification to the mayoress behind. While all this was going forward, Ned Twigger had descended into the kitchen of Mudfog Hall for the purpose of indulging the servants with a private view of the curiosity that was to burst upon the town, and, somehow or other, the footman was so companionable, and the housemaid so kind, and the cook so friendly, that he could not resist the offer of the first mentioned to sit down and take something, just a drink success to master in. So, down Ned Twigger sat himself in his brass livery on the top of the kitchen table, and in a mug of something strong, paid for by the unconscious Nicholas Tulrumble, and provided by the companionable footman, drank success to the mayor and his procession, and, as Ned laid by his helmet to imbibe the something strong, the companionable footman put it on his own head, to the immeasurable and unrecordable delight of the cook and housemaid. The companionable footman was very facetious to Ned, and Ned was very gallant to the cook and housemaid by turns. They were all very cozy and comfortable, and the something strong went briskly round. At last Ned Twigger was loudly called for, by the procession people, and, having had his helmet fixed on,